not be on. Mel Baker, 4KQED.
All right, everybody loves a good mystery. Thanks, Mel. Have a great day. Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED comes from Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis. Visitors can currently explore Deborah Butterfield, P.S. These Are Not Horses, through June 30th, 2024. Coming up on Science Friday later this morning, a classic science fiction author also wrote the military's textbook on how to conduct psychological warfare, How Stories Can Be Weapons. Science Friday, one of the stories you'll hear today. It comes up this morning at 11. Sunshine today, temperatures ranging from the upper 50s at the ocean to the low 80s inland. Good morning, I'm Sandy Althaus. You're listening to member-supported radio, KQED-FM San Francisco, KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento. The time is 9 a.m.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. The San Francisco Opera debuted a new and hotly anticipated show last week called Innocence. The opera revolves around a shooting at an international school and the grief and trauma that linger a decade after the event. We'll talk about the production as well as the community initiatives that spun out of it, because Innocence arrives at a moment in the United States in which more and more people are living in close proximity to the tragedies of gun violence. Why and what can we do about it? That's all coming up next, right after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Biden's publicly apologizing for the first time to the Ukrainian people for Congress's holdup of U.S. military assistance. Tens of billions of dollars in aid and weaponry were delayed for months during the White House's spending feud with congressional Republicans. Today, Biden met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Paris on the sidelines of 80th anniversary D-Day events. Biden announced an additional $225 million aid package for Ukraine. A short time ago, Biden spoke at the site of a monument to Army Rangers who helped defeat the Nazis in World War II. He invoked their legacy in defense of Ukraine's fight against an invasion ordered by Russian President Vladimir Putin.
They stood against Hitler's aggression. Does anyone doubt that they would want America to stand up against Putin's aggression here in Europe today? They stormed the beaches alongside our allies. Does anyone believe these Rangers would want America to go it alone today?
Back home, the president's son is on trial in Delaware on federal gun charges. The prosecution has rested its case against Hunter Biden. The defendant's charged with lying about his illegal drug use when he purchased a handgun in 2018. NPR's Ryan Lucas has the latest.
The jury heard from two government expert witnesses this morning, an FBI chemist and a Drug Enforcement Administration special agent, before prosecutors rested their case. The DEA special agent testified about the drug language in Hunter Biden's text messages, telling jurors, for example, that a reference to baby powder was code for powder cocaine. Hunter Biden's attorney, Abby Lowell, has said he expects to call two or three witnesses for the defense. He also says no decision has been made yet on whether Hunter Biden will take the stand to testify in his own defense. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, outside the federal courthouse in Wilmington, Delaware.
Thousands of people turned out in Arizona yesterday to hear from former President Donald Trump. Cameron Sanchez with member station KJZZ says it was Trump's first appearance in the state in nearly 2 years.
Addressing his first campaign rally since being convicted in New York court, Trump pledged to facilitate mass deportations and said repeatedly that the United States should execute drug dealers.
We will begin the largest domestic deportation operation in the history of our country. Have no choice. We have no choice. Biden has given us no choice.
Trump also promised to rescind, quote, on day one, Biden's recent executive order limiting the amount of people who can cross the border seeking asylum. For NPR News in Phoenix, I'm Cameron Sanchez.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 47 points at 38,933. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. The Alameda City Council this week pulled the plug on an experiment by climate scientists over safety concerns, despite a report that concluded there was no risk. KQED's science reporter Danielle Venton explains.
The experiment was set aboard the USS Hornet and involved spraying a combo of sea salt water components and tap water into the air. Here's project scientist Sarah Doherty from the University of Washington speaking at an Alameda City Council meeting.
So we're spraying aerosol that is extremely similar to sea salt spray on the flight deck, making specific measurements downwind on the flight deck of the Hornet. And these are not being done at a scale that can alter clouds, weather, or the climate.
The experiment was intended to collect basic information to feed into larger scale models. One day, scientists could use sea salt to intentionally brighten clouds, reflecting more heat away from Earth to counteract climate change. But the project had not sought the city's permission before starting, believing it wasn't required. So in April, Alameda asked the scientists to halt operations while they waited for the results of a city commission safety study. The study found no risk. Despite that, the city council meeting was filled with extreme concerns and hostile remarks from some members of the public and from council members. Here's council member Trish Herrera Spencer.
I do not support moving forward ever here in Alameda on this.
The council voted unanimously to shut the project down. The study scientists expressed disappointment and urged the council to reconsider. I'm Danielle Venton, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. There's more at kqed.org.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And by the listeners of KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. It is a sad fact of modern life that gun violence is so widespread. And as we'll hear in this show, gun violence has spread geographically through our cities too, putting more people into proximity with this particular kind of trauma. In this setting, the San Francisco Opera has staged a new production, the American premiere of the opera Innocence. And here to discuss what the opera offers to our area and our moment, we're joined by Matthew Schilbach, General Director of the San Francisco Opera. Welcome.
Good morning, Alexis.
We're also joined by Gabe Moline, Senior Editor with KQED Arts and Culture. Welcome, Gabe. Matthew, I wanted to start with you. First, congrats on the premiere. We've been seeing really great reviews, including one by Gabe, and we've heard it's had a great reception. Tell us a little bit about the show and why you're so excited about it.
Well, thank you so much, Alexis. Yeah, this opera, which just opened last Friday, is, I think, one of the most important pieces of theater, of opera, to emerge in the last few decades. Mm-hmm. It is a piece that takes this incredibly difficult subject of gun violence and examines it through this very holistic emotional lens. Mm. And so as we move through this 100-minute opera, it's just one act, you just move straight through it as an audience member, and gradually you unfold your own understanding of how the characters are interacting. These 13 characters are on stage, and all of the multiplicity of emotional reactions, both in the incident itself, which we don't see the actual shooting, but we see the aftermath of it, and then what has happened 10 years on. And so it's this constant back and forth between the future and the past as we see the totality of what this incredibly difficult incident has happened.
You know, this set design of this feels like it's a really important part of how the opera works. Tell us a little bit about how that actually works.
Yeah, this set designed by Chloe Lamford and this production by Simon Stone is a two-story cube. and it's always in motion. It's rotating throughout the whole opera. And as it rotates, it morphs and changes. And so as we're watching it as audience members, the crew is backstage changing it around so that what's a schoolroom becomes a wedding reception. What is a closet becomes a kitchen. We're in this constant state of motion and sort of perpetual unfolding of this story, and we feel that emotionally as audience members through the set and then through the extraordinary music of Kaija Saariaho.
Yeah. Let's hear a little clip from opening night last Saturday. That was a short excerpt from the opera Innocence, which is up now at the San Francisco Opera. Can you tell us, Matthew, a little bit more about this composer, the Finnish composer Kaija Saariaho?
Kaija Saariaho is one of the great composers of our time. She sadly passed away almost a year ago to the day. This is her last opera, and she is someone who, through her entire career, really pushed the boundaries on unfolding how music can be perceived. Her musical work comes out of a very scientific, mathematical technique, but in doing so, she actually creates this music of incredible celestial freedom. Mm-hmm. And we heard a little bit of it there with Vilma Jahr and Ruxandra Danoz, the two singers we just heard, and you feel just this time being morphed into a completely different reality. Mm. And we see that through the opera, both through music that is exquisitely beautiful like that, and then these sort of gut-wrenching moments where we just feel completely in the moment of the tragedy. Mm. So she's somebody who was able to take time and music and bring them into a completely different sense of relief through instrumentation. We have a huge percussion section in the orchestra pit. We have to like squeeze everybody in because there are so many colors that she brings out through the music. It's extraordinary writing.
Gabe Moline, senior editor here at the station with KQED Arts and Culture. Gabe, you saw this and you called it a masterwork with your review for KQED. Why?
You know, I've only been reviewing opera at KQED for about 6 years or so, but Innocence is really the best contemporary opera I've ever seen. Alexis, I don't go seeking out works of art about school shootings. In fact, maybe this has happened to you too. It got to the point where I couldn't bring myself to read articles about every new school shooting in this country, you know, like you have to preserve your mental health. Yeah. But you feel a sense of guilt when you pass over these articles, like you're contributing to the normalization of mass shootings. Innocence is masterful because it shocks you out of that complacency. And it's not like a preachy or finger-wagging opera. All it does is tell a story about a school shooting and its aftermath 10 years later. And then about three quarters of the way through, we start learning twists in the story and additional context about the students. And it just peels back layers and layers of the enduring pain and trauma caused by this shooting. It's really, really effective.
Gabe, what do you think about it being an opera, right? I mean, we've seen so many different types of media through time about school shootings. Do you think opera has a special role to play here?
I will admit, I was very dubious when I heard about Innocence. An opera about a school shooting? Real? Are you serious? Because if you get just a tiny bit of it wrong, then you get all of it wrong, right? It's such a delicate subject. I didn't expect it to be as successful in what it does as it did. And, you know, like I said, I haven't been covering opera very long. I was raised on punk rock and rap in the Bay Area here. But this is what I would say is, even if you don't think you like opera, even if, you know, you were raised on punk rock and rap in the Bay Area, this is one to see. This could be a very good first opera. People say, oh, you know, your first opera should be The Magic Flute, or it should be Carmen. Innocence is only an hour and 45 minutes long, and it feels like a movie, you know, not just in length, but in style. The set that Matthew talked about is remarkable. There's so many standout young actors in this opera, but mainly it's that thing that it does. You know, the great Berkeley punk band Operation Ivy once sang about the human species that our insensitivity is our biggest vulnerability. And this opera reminded me of that. It shakes you out of being desensitized and to never take a school shooting for granted ever again.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Gabe Moline. Everyone can read his review on kqed.org, of course. Thanks for joining us this morning, Gabe.
Thanks, Alexis.
I want to bring in Ryan Marchand, director of San Francisco Opera's Department of Diversity, Equity, and Community. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you so much.
And Ryan, you know, how do you see this show fitting in with the opera's mission to bring in new audiences and collaborations?
Well, I think early on when we were looking at Innocence, Matthew and I had a discussion, and we talked about the sort of feeling the pressure to feel like we had to do more than just present the work itself, that because the subject matter was so large and so heavy that we really needed to create a container to hold it all. And I think early on we agreed that to speak to the issue of gun violence, we had to really acknowledge the breadth of it. And so, of course, this opera centers on a mass shooting in a high school. Mm-hmm. But we have to acknowledge that the breadth of the gun violence issue is so much more than that. There's so much gun violence and mass shootings that happen every single day in communities that don't get reported on the news and are not hyper-sensationalized. So when we took that step back and really allowed ourselves to acknowledge that breadth of the issue, that's where we really started to look at the partnerships and who could help us hold this piece, because we also acknowledge that we're really inspired by this piece of art. It's an incredible piece of art, but the art and us, those producing it, are not the ones actually on the ground in community addressing the issues day to day. And so that's where we really were honored to be able to enter into partnership.
And you created sort of a container for it that you call Beyond Innocence, right? And it's like a set of programming and other kinds of partnerships?
Yeah, so Beyond Innocence encompasses trauma-informed training that we provided for all of the company and cast members to acknowledge that what we're asking people to hold and embody throughout this process and trying to take care of ourselves throughout that process. That also includes last Friday on May 31st, we had a day-long symposium where we brought together national, local, civic, artistic leaders to be in conversation about the issues and the work that is happening to create safety in communities. That also included all the partners that we're working with to activate the Opera House post show, and acknowledging that watching that performance is so visceral and has the capacity to leave people potentially feeling traumatized. And so we wanted to create space in the Opera House for people to collectively process that and to be in space together and to be able to be in dialogue together. And hopefully we're also imparting people with a sense of hope, because the partners that we are working with, they are doing incredible work on the ground. They are creating safety in communities, and they are doing actual work to disrupt that violence. Yeah. So Beyond Innocence was sort of looking at how are we as the company holding it? How are we bringing people into that conversation, and how are we creating space for people to be together in the issues?
We're talking about Innocence, a new production at the San Francisco Opera. And as you just heard, we're also talking about Beyond Innocence, which is a set of community programs that the opera has built around this production. It's about the long-term effects of gun violence. We're joined this morning by Matthew Schilbach, General Director, San Francisco Opera. Ryan Marchand, also with the opera. Earlier, you heard from Gabe Moline, Senior Editor with KQED Arts and Culture.
We want to hear from you. Maybe you've seen Innocence. Maybe you had a reaction to it and you wanted to give us a call. Or maybe you've been affected by a shooting in your community. You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. The email is forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more right after the break.
Support for KQED comes from Summitree Wealth Management, engineered for life in the Bay Area, helping clients maximize opportunities through personalized financial planning and investment strategies for over 20 years. More at summitry.com. The San Francisco SPCA, where adoption fees are waived on animals 5 months and older through June. Listeners can find a furry new friend at the Adoption Center at 250 Florida or sfspca.org.
I'm Leslie McClurg in for Mina Kim. Next time on Forum at 10 a.m., the influence of the Tea Party on American politics. The right-wing populist movement has lost its funding arm as the conservative group Freedom Works shuts down, and as followers join the MAGA movement. We look at the history of the Tea Party and how it's shaped today's GOP. That's Forum at 10 a.m. on KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about Innocence, a new production at the San Francisco Opera, which centers around a mass shooting at a school. We're also talking about Beyond Innocence, the opera's set of community initiatives and the long effects of gun violence. We're joined by Matthew Schilbach, General Director of the Opera, Ryan Marchand, Director of the Opera's Department of Diversity, Equity, and Community. And we want to bring in Shyla Dewan, who is a national criminal justice correspondent at the New York Times. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Shyla, you worked on a recent New York Times kind of investigation that looked at data around how the pandemic impacted gun violence. What kind of trends did you see in that data?
We saw that violence, everybody knows that violence got worse during the pandemic, and we saw the huge spike in 2021 in homicides and shootings. In some cities, it's continued to be very elevated. Some cities were even seeing record levels of gun violence last year. And in other places, it's receded a bit, but it has not gone back to our pre-pandemic levels. And the second big thing we saw was that not only did bad neighborhoods get worse, but the gun violence spread out. And so as a result, many more Americans have been exposed to fatal gun violence than were before. 20% more, in fact. So this is millions more Americans who lived near fatal gun violence that occurred after the pandemic.
And so when you say that, there's some numbers from the piece that I'm just going to quote here, which is, it's the percentage of people who live within a quarter mile, right, of a fatal shooting. That's kind of the measure.
That was our measure.
Yeah. And so Oakland, it's 73% of people. San Francisco, 37%. San Jose, 16%. These are extremely high numbers of people who are in close proximity to this kind of violence.
That's right. I mean, and so part of my job after my colleague Rob Gebeloff crunched these numbers was to go out and find out, like, what does that feel like? What does it feel like when that has spread out so much and it's touching so many more people than it was before? And I will note, just, I mean, it's just as an aside, it's very interesting that you saw very different patterns in different cities. So while these numbers are high, the increase in San Francisco was much less than the increase in Oakland, where you saw a huge jump, meaning the violence spread out more in Oakland, whereas in San Francisco, the number of new people exposed to violence was a much smaller jump than we saw in other cities.
Yeah. Do you have any analysis of that, of like why we saw these particular patterns? I mean, I know that I feel like I think I know the answer, and the answer is no, but what do you think?
That's such a good question. I mean, you know, every city is different. And, you know, San Francisco is certainly unique in many, many ways. I think what I would just say is, like, that most cities saw this spread. Four out of five American cities saw this spread. So it's nothing unique. Or I think it would be like, you'd probably have to say that San Francisco is more unique than every other city that saw the spread.
You also did a deep dive examining Columbus, Ohio. I mean, talk to me a little bit about why Columbus and then how you focused that story.
Why Columbus? I would like to say no reason, because it could have been so many different cities. And in fact, I looked at a number of cities that were potential candidates for this story, and which meant that they fit our pattern of spreading gun violence. And I came back to my editors and I said, look, we could really do any of these cities. We could go to Albuquerque, we could go to Louisville, we could go to Memphis, we could go to Columbus. And so for Columbus, where the people are really great. I met so many wonderful people there, and I picked them and made them a poster child for something that was not unique to Columbus. It's just that Columbus was really emblematic of what other cities were experiencing. In other words, a city where you don't normally think of when you think of gun violence. You don't think Columbus, oh, it's really a problem there, you know, and yet here they are experiencing it in a way that's really vivid to the people who live there. And again, this was not unique. I found communities around the country who were saying, what can we do about this? And really stopping to focus on the issue.
You know, one of the things that you did in your feature on Columbus was also to focus on, you know, one shooting and the way that it really changed one community, not just in the moment, but over this kind of like long term, just to tie us into the kind of theme of this opera that we're talking about too, of this kind of these long range effects of how the world just becomes different to people who've experienced this kind of violence.
Right. Do you want me to tell that story?
Yeah.
First of all, I just want to say that I really need to see this opera. So when is it coming to New York?
Yeah.
You can answer that later. So the story, this incident in Columbus, and believe me, I looked at so many different shooting incidents in doing this article. I really zoomed in on many, many different shootings that had occurred around the city in our time frame. And this one really stuck out to me because it encapsulated so many of the things we were seeing. So you have a neighborhood, suburban, big lawns, big leafy trees, you know, ranch houses and children's play forts, just a normal neighborhood in East Columbus. There is a couple that has lived there for three decades. And they moved there from the inner city in order to escape violence. They wanted to raise their daughters in a safer area. So they moved to the east side, and eventually they found this house. And then they not only raised their daughters on the east side, but in this particular house, they raised their granddaughter. Mm. Her name is Sheree. She grew up. She met a guy and got married. And the two of them would go and visit her grandparents quite a bit. One Father's Day, 2021, they went over to celebrate Father's Day. The whole family was there. And when Sheree and her husband, Jason, were leaving, a neighbor came up to them as they were getting in their car, and he's got a gun. And he is trying to scare them. And Jason also had a gun. He had a permitted handgun in his waistband that he carried at all times. And Sheree doesn't know what's going on. Everybody is screaming. I've seen video of this. And she doesn't. This neighbor was quite elderly, by the way. And so she's known him all her life. And she ducks behind the car to call 911 while her grandfather and Jason are trying to disarm this man. And all of a sudden there are shots. Sheree's mom is running to the house to get her father's shotgun. And Sheree steps back around and sees her husband lying dead on the street.
Shot by like a former military member with a ghost gun. Yeah.
Right. So what has happened is this guy who lives across the street, who's an ex-Marine, young guy, he has built a military-style assault rifle in his basement. He hears the commotion, doesn't know what is happening, steps to his door. He sees his neighbor on the ground with these two guys trying to disarm him, and he misinterprets the situation and shoots Jason dead.
Oh, jeez.
So you have here four guns, all of which are legally owned. And you have, it was like a dispute. This elderly neighbor believed that Jason and Sheree were, you know, he had kind of fantastical, grievances against them. And he believed that they were, troubling him. So that's why he came after them with the gun. And the whole thing is just like, it just struck me as like, in some other time, this would have just been a loud argument.
Right. I mean, and I think, you know, it gets at a couple of key themes of just like the raw number of guns in this country of all different kinds used by different people and to transform what, yeah, would have been a suburban dispute, very simple, into, you know, a real tragedy. You know, we actually have a caller on the line, Julian in San Jose, who has a related question. Welcome, Julian.
Hi, thank you. I was just wondering if y'all had looked at gun ownership and increases in gun ownership relative to this as possibly an explanation for why this got so much worse.
Yeah, Julian, thanks for that.
Yes, Julian. So a lot of people have tried to look at gun ownership. It is very difficult to track because there are so many ways of acquiring a gun that don't require you to go through any official channels. Many states, including Ohio, have sort of done away with permitting and licensing. So what we know is that you're right in the sense that the number of guns out there has increased dramatically. And we just know that from numbers that are reported to the ATF, that more and more guns are produced for domestic sale in the US. But we don't have great numbers about whether, you know, those are all, like, maybe one person is buying 200 guns or 200 people are buying 200 guns. So we don't have clear numbers on gun ownership, but by all anecdotal evidence and a lot of statistical evidence, it is spreading.
Yeah. You know, Matthew Schilbach, general director of the SF Opera, which is, of course, has Innocence On, about a shooting incident at international school. When you hear stories like this now, has your relationship to gun violence changed by your work in this production?
It really has, and just hearing that story and the many layers of that story, I think where my mind goes now after being in this piece of innocence for the last few months is the repercussions of that. Mm-hmm. We hear a story like that, we try to visualize what it's like in the moment, mm-hmm. and then, I think as Gabe said earlier, we then sort of move on to the next story, and we sort of consume these stories in the moment. But for the people who are in that story, who are left behind in that story, what is the long-term impact of that? And I think that's as we see that unfold in the opera in these incredible ways as a character of a teacher, a character of a priest, and their entire worldview is upended. Mm. The teacher says, you know, at one point in the opera, I just realized I can no longer be a teacher. I am spending my entire time looking for clues. I can no longer do the profession that I trained to be. And the same for the priest. He says, you know, my faith, I've gone through so much in life. I've seen so much, but this has really rocked my faith. And
clues
so,
to what? Like just that if there's meaning in life?
Well, I think that the teacher in that case is talking about after she has gone through this shooting, she is looking at every paper. As she reads every paper, she's looking for a word, for a syntax that is giving some clue that she missed in this prior student. And that's a part of this that I never really thought about myself. You know, what is the impact for teachers in school shootings, and how do they process this for decades afterwards, let alone the family members? So as I hear a story like that, it really does change my perspective.
We're talking about the San Francisco Opera's production of Innocence, which is about a mass shooting in an international school and the grief and trauma of gun violence and how it lingers. We're joined by Matthew Schilbach, general director of the San Francisco Opera,
Shyla Dewan, National Criminal Justice Correspondent with the New York Times, and Brian Marchand, Director of the San Francisco Opera's Department of Diversity, Equity, and Community. And I want to add another voice into the conversation. Tanish Hollins is Executive Director of Californians for Safety and Justice and co-founder and co-director of San Francisco Black Wall Street Foundation. Welcome, Tanish.
Thank you for having me.
So as we are talking about the repercussions of this kind of gun violence, how have you tried to approach this in your community organization?
Well, we have a national network of crime victims and survivors called Crime Survivors for Safety and Justice. And here in California, we have about 50,000 members. We have an overrepresentation of victims and survivors of gun violence in our membership. Most of our members tend to be from underrepresented communities of color, communities that are often overrepresented in this kind of violence, but the stories of how gun violence impacts communities and survivors is often overlooked.
Yeah. Well, and you know, there's obviously like multiple kinds of proximity. There's what Shyla was telling us about earlier about, you know, kind of the spread of this thing to gun violence to different neighborhoods. How what's your relationship to this kind of gun violence, your very personal relationship to it?
Unfortunately, I've experienced gun violence in my immediate family. I've lost two brothers to gun violence here in San Francisco, in fact. And I also saw and still experience the direct impact of that trauma in my family. My youngest brother surrendered his own life about 2.5 years ago. Oh. The impact on our mental health, the way that we see ourselves and engage with our family and community totally changes. Our sense of safety totally changes. You know, for folks who already have underlying issues, I think this type of trauma, gun violence specifically, just exacerbates it because of the hypervigilance that you have about never knowing when and how something like this could happen again, especially if you're in a community that sees frequent incidents of gun violence.
Yeah, I can imagine. Right, you hear gunshots in places quite often. What have you done to sort of help yourself? I don't know, reckon with those incidents or heal in some ways.
Well, community definitely helps. Unfortunately, there are too many people that have been impacted by gun violence, but you know, Innocence is a great example of the ways that community can communicate how this dynamic plays out and the layers that folks have to peel back to kind of regain their footing in society. And I think it really helps build the compassion. For me, myself, therapy has been a help. Being in community with other survivors who have had similar experiences but have been on a healing journey and, you know, taking practical steps to kind of get back into their life. And also advocacy. Advocacy is a big part of my life and my healing process. I think the stories that we each carry have a lot of nuance about, you know, what gun violence is and how it happens and, you know, the impacts that it has on people and the need for immediate support, but also long-term support. So sharing our stories is a big part of the healing process for me, and I know for a lot of survivors that are in our network.
So what's the relationship of the work that you're doing with, you know, in collaborating with this big, you know, arts institution here in the city?
So, I mean, participating in the symposium was an amazing experience. And then actually watching Innocence, you know, kind of like Gabe, I'm a Bay Area native from San Francisco, definitely raised on rap and punk music and had never been to the opera. So to have experience to, you know, see this production in a contemporary sense where it was relatable, I think was really helpful and beautiful. And to invite other community members in to see this production and to kind of unpack it together, and then to continue building that relationship by inviting those organizations and those of us who are doing the work on the ground back to the opera so that we can engage with, you know, the guests and folks who are enjoying this production while it's here.
We're talking about the San Francisco Opera's production of Innocence, joined by Tanish Hollins, Executive Director of Californians for Safety and Justice, Matthew Schilbach and Ryan Marchand, both of the opera. And we're also joined by Shyla Dewan, who's National Criminal Justice Correspondent with the New York Times. We'd love to hear from you.
How have you been affected by shooting in your community? Are you worried about your proximity to gun violence? You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Maybe you've seen Innocence and had a reaction to it. You can email that too to forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned. Up in the next hour of Forum with guest host Guy Marzorati, the influence of the Tea Party on American politics. The right-wing populist movement has lost its funding arm as the conservative group Freedom Works shuts down and as followers join the MAGA movement. We look at the history of the Tea Party and how it shaped today's GOP. Hey, I also wanted to give a special shout out to Forum fans and newlyweds Fiona Benjamin and Rick Duenas. They asked me to marry them, and I helped them tie the knot in front of their families on the beach in Pacifica. As the great Mary Oliver said, joy is not meant to be a crumb. Congratulations. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about the San Francisco Opera's production of Innocence, which centers on the aftermath of a mass shooting at a school. We're joined by Matthew Schilbach, General Director of San Francisco Opera, Ryan Marchand, Director of San Francisco Opera's Department of Diversity, Equity, and Community, Tanish Holland, Executive Director of Californians for Safety and Justice, and Shiloh Dewan, National Criminal Justice Correspondent with the New York Times. We're also taking your calls and comments. You know, if there was a shooting in your community, how did that event impact the dynamic of your neighborhood? Or perhaps you're a survivor of gun violence. What's been most helpful in your healing process? You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786, or you can email forum@kqed.org. You know, Matthew, I wanted to ask you, you know, what do we think of the role of this kind of art in healing in our culture? I mean, Gabe's review really notes this kind of cathartic impact of the show, saying, you know, Innocence is about this kind of loss, not just a loss of innocence, but a loss of sense or meaning. Can a show like this help bring back some of that meaning?
I think it's a wonderful example of how art can take us to a different place around an issue that we grapple with all the time. And Tanisha just was talking about peeling back the layers, and there are so many layers to trauma, and we all experience some form of trauma, and in a piece like this we can all bring our own experiences to bear in it. And there's something incredibly powerful about being in a collective space together where we are sharing in common storytelling, and that is happening far too rarely now, I think, in the world, where people just gather in a trusted space and explore what it means to be human together. Mm-hmm. And I think a piece like this, which pulls us so viscerally into the subject matter, into the characters, into the forward motion of this story unfolding. And again, it's told as this mystery that unfolds over time. So we are all experiencing these emotional shifts together. And there's just something so cathartic, I think, about being in something collectively and understanding that at some root we are all grappling with versions of the same things. So to me, that's one of the huge powers of art, particularly the theatrical arts, is that notion of how we tell stories and then how we pass stories down from generation to generation.
Tanish, how did you experience it?
Yeah, it definitely was the story for me. Just seeing each of the characters and the mystery, like what was the elephant in the room, right? Mm-hmm. And to have it unveiled, right, that the elephant in the room is that this terrible tragedy has taken place and the impact that it's had on everyone's lives. I definitely saw my own experience in some ways coming through the characters and people that I know, you know, people in my immediate family and how they have been able to process or not process their experience. I think there's also this point about guilt and innocence, right? Mm. Who's actually responsible for this that we all had to unpack together in watching the watching this art piece. And I think that is a conversation that is living in community around this issue of gun violence, like who is responsible? And so I think it was very powerful and compelling, and just to experience it with, you know, everyone in the room processing in their own way was definitely cathartic.
You know, Ryan, one thing that I wanted to ask you was about what the experience for the performers in this opera has been like. I mean, these are incredibly difficult and heavy themes, and they're sort of inhabiting this space of violence. How did you all kind of try and prepare and work with them in this way?
Yeah, well, I think opera is so expansive in the way that it expresses the breadth of the human experience. And it's sort of funny when you think about it, we're like, oh, just go up on stage and then portray and embody, you know, the expansiveness of what it means to be a human, you know,
That's
just your job. That's your day job. Yeah. It's not a normal job, or quote unquote normal. So I think we just really tried to think about centering and acknowledging people's humanity, that each performer, each administrator, each person on the crew has a unique lived experience. And unfortunately, statistically speaking, many of us have our lived experience informed by gun violence through direct experience or, you know, so we had to acknowledge that this embodying this piece and holding it for so long had the potential, had the capacity to trigger people, to activate people. So in acknowledging that, we really tried to, we did some research on trauma-informed creative practice, you know, just thinking about the autonomic nervous system and how triggering happens in the body. If someone is in a triggered state, if a performer is in a triggered state while they're working on this piece, that cuts off access to the parts of your brain that you need to express creativity and to be social and to work in a creative space. So trauma and creativity can't occupy the same space. It's like going against the laws of physics. So we had to acknowledge, how do you create support systems so if a performer or if someone working on the production is triggered and is activated, what do they need to take care of themselves first so that we can continue to complete the task at hand, which is create this art piece and hopefully get it out and foster that dialogue.
Yeah, so fascinating. Also on the opera, you know, one of our listeners, Bill, notes, you know, we're talking about the opera Innocent as if it were a play or purely literary work. So he says, as an opera, could we hear a little bit more about the music? And Matthew, I think this goes to you.
That's a great question, Bill. And again, this is the epitome of one of the great composers' crafts. And Kaija Saariaho understood the orchestra and the human voice at a deep, deep level. And what we see in Innocence is this expression of individual perspectives. It was so important to Kaija that this be a story about 13 individuals experiencing a shared experience, but through very different lenses. And again, this is how it invites us as audience members into our own experiences and reflections on our own experiences. Each character has a very unique tempo marking, instrumentation, style attached to them. And you know, this is something we don't experience when we watch the piece. We're not thinking this intellectually. But if you look at how Kaija composed the piece, each of the characters has a very unique musical fingerprint. And then that is woven together into this very cinematic score. In fact, the entire experience of Innocence is one of a sort of cinematic energy, I think. And the music just never, ever lets up, but again, takes us through this emotional journey. It was so important to Kaija that the piece not be longer than 1 hour, 40 minutes. She just didn't feel that a person could hold this subject for this. And so it's there's no intermission. You go straight through. And again, you look at how she constructed the piece, and it is with, you know, huge respect for the audience, I think, so that they can have that profound experience. And at the end, this is absolutely beautiful moment where the one character who is the murdered daughter of this waitress
she is in dialogue with her mother, and she is basically saying to her mother, you keep buying me these presents for my birthdays. For 10 years, you've bought me a present on my birthday. You keep going to the school and waiting for me. Mm. Please let me go. Mm. And as this is expressed, the music just opens up to the lowest note in the orchestra, the highest note in the orchestra, and it's as though sort of light is being let in, and this incredible spirit of hope, difficult hope, but still a sense of hope at the end. It's just an incredible moment.
Yeah. Tanisha, in your own experience, how important is that sort of letting go? It seems like such a difficult thing to do.
It is a challenge. You know, healing gives you perspective. They say time changes things, but it's actually you being intentional in your healing journey and your perspective. And I have experienced that moment that, you know, you referenced personally. It is important because that level of trauma definitely does block your access to life. And we see, I know so many people who've experienced this type of trauma who physically are still here, but spiritually and emotionally are gone because they cannot move through it. And so it's important to, you know, continue to invest in that. The storytelling is a part of that healing process. And I think that's what innocence does. It helps us to tell those stories in a way that we can release, right? Mm-hmm. And also know that while it's a very personal experience for many of us, we as a society are experiencing collectively the impact of it. We all have a responsibility of unpacking it together so that we can let go and we can move forward.
You know, Shaila Dewan, just to bring you back into the conversation here, you also worked with or spoke with a group in Columbus called Mothers of Murdered Children. What really struck you about the work that they were doing to combat gun violence and to bring healing to the community?
I just thought this group was so amazing because it was born out of trauma, like Tanisha's speaking about, and they really... they did not have a punitive, vengeful approach. They really have a very community-based approach about meeting people where they are. And by that, I mean literally, like, they will go and line a roadway with signs. The idea is that, look at me, I lost a kid. Don't you want this to stop? They're talking to their own community. They're going to where homicides occur, giving people blankets, explaining what is going on, what are the police doing, why won't the police let me go over there. And they're also using PSAs, using data-driven approaches, partnering with all kinds of people. They have a thing in Columbus where they call in those people who they think are most at risk of committing gun violence. They give them a kind of talking to, and they offer them services at the same time. So it's kind of a choice, like, you could continue down this path or you can get help from us. And the Mothers of Murdered Columbus Children come there and talk to those people as well. And they also turn out. They just dress in these amazing uniforms and they have their visuals together. So they're just really and they're very intentional about what they're doing. The brains behind that group is a middle school teacher who's just... I've just never really met someone who had such drive and focus.
Let's bring in Tarnal in Richmond. Welcome. Hey, Tarnal, can you hear me?
I can, yes.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I live in Richmond, California, and at the time of the Oklahoma City bombing, I had just really weeks before that, there had been a drive-by shooting at the house directly across the street from me where a young man was mistakenly identified and shot 17 times. And he was a peacemaker kid. He was a good kid. And the target was his brother. In my neighborhood, I saw people spreading rumors about how he was a gang member and other ugly things. This kid was a star athlete in the local high school and had a career ahead of him that was cut short. He survived. okay? But I was really, I was so upset with how my neighbors treated the family, and they moved. That family, they moved almost immediately.
Hey. And
within a week of that was the Oklahoma City bombing.
Man.
At the same time, I was a children's librarian, and I was putting on a conference. And I ended up getting healing from my community of children's librarians, where I was allowed to bring forward stories in a bibliography. These were stories for children about courage, and we titled it, Call It Courage. My being able to share my personal experience of this trauma right across the street from my home and the larger trauma of what happened to those children in Oklahoma City was crucial to my being able to continue to live in a neighborhood, in a city that I truly love. And as a community, we have stood up against violence. We now have one of the lowest crime rates, or not crime rates, but we have the lowest murder rate that we've seen in decades. And I do think that part of the what goes on, or part of what we can do, even though, and I'm sorry, I'm very emotional about this.
Yeah, no, it makes sense, Tarnal. It totally makes sense.
I know that we all bear responsibility for the violence in our world. I think it's really important that we understand that we also hold the solutions. And there's so much inequity, so much financial, economic disparity, so much injustice in the world, and there's so much hopelessness. And there's hopelessness among the young people. And we can make changes.
Tarnal, thank you. Thank you so much. I just want to bring this to Nish. I know that you've been doing this work, and thank you so much for sharing your experience, Tarnal, and the weight of it. Tanish, there's so much in what she just said. You know, maybe just what do you hear in it? And go ahead.
Yeah, just thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. There's a lot there, right? And I think the one thing where Eternal ended was on the solutions, right? And that's we are the solution. And the solutions really are at community level. We have to acknowledge that there are disparities. We have to acknowledge that there are whole communities of people who have had been victims of crime, right? Not just gun violence, but that victimization has been ignored because of where they live or what they look like. And this issue of who we hold compassion for, whether or not they are guilty or innocent.
Right, just like Tarnal was saying.
Exactly. Yeah. Without looking at the harm that's been done and the underlying cause of the harm and why it continues to happen. So until we get to a place where we can kind of start breaking that binary, it's not that we're saying people shouldn't be held accountable when they commit a harm, but why are we so focused on that instead of what's driving the harm in the first place? When we have, you know, whole communities of people who are under-resourced, who are cut off from access to mental health, who don't have space to process that type of trauma in community. One of the things that Tarnal, you know, mentioned about her healing process or their healing process is the opportunity to unpack that in community and have it acknowledged. And that doesn't often happen, especially in communities that see high rates or higher rates of gun violence and crime. And that's part of the work that we do with Crime Survivors for Safety and Justice. And, you know, with groups like Mothers of Murdered Children. I know many survivors across the country, but especially here in California and some in San Francisco, who started those organizations out of their living room.
Right.
With no funding, with no blueprint. But they knew, what they knew was that they didn't want anyone else to experience what they experienced.
Want to get in one last comment here. Chris writes, I moved from Santa Clara to Morgan Hill shortly after the Gilroy Garlic Festival shooting in 2019, and the festival has not been held since. The trauma is clearly still around, as I still see bumper stickers and signs that say Gilroy Strong. One of the reasons that the event since has been canceled is because the cost of insurance for events like these shot up as a direct result of these mass shootings. We're left with a community traumatized by not just the loss of life and lasting memories, but unable to reclaim the event as something that should create happy memories or to hold similar events as a place for community celebration. Hopefully that can come back. We have been talking about San Francisco Opera's production of Innocence with Tanish Hollins, Executive Director of Californians for Safety and Justice. Thanks, Tanish.
Thank you for having me.
Matthew Schilbach, General Director of the San Francisco Opera. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you, Alexis.
Ryan Marchand, Director of SF Opera's Department of Diversity, Equity, and Community.
Thank you so much.
And Shyla Dewan, National Criminal Justice Correspondent with the New York Times. Thank you, Shyla.
Thanks for having us.
Earlier, we spoke with Gabe Moline, Senior Editor of KQED Arts and Culture. You can read his review of the show, which he called a masterwork. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with guest host Guy Marzorati.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.